Welcome, everyone, to the Most Notorious Podcast. I'm Eric Rivenis, pleased as punch to have you here with me yet again. Hope you are having a nice start to your summer. I am very excited to be talking today to award-winning and best-selling author Blaine Hardin. He is a longtime foreign correspondent who worked for the Washington Post from Africa, Eastern Europe, and Northeast Asia. He was also a national correspondent for the New York Times, a contributor to The Economist, and has reported for PBS Frontline. Among other accomplishments, he has written three acclaimed books about North Korea. His latest book is called Murder at the Mission, A Frontier Killing, Its Legacy of Lies, and The Taking of the American West. Welcome. Thank you for joining me today.
Oh, it's a great to be here. Thanks.
Yes. So when do you first remember hearing about the murders at the Whitman Mission?
I was a kid in elementary school in Moses Lake, Washington, which is in eastern Washington, a couple hours drive north of the place where the killing took place, outside Walla Walla. And we were all asked to perform in a play about Marcus and Narcissa Whitman and how they were killed by nasty Indians. And in the play, Marcus and Narcissa were heroes, and the Indians were sneaky. And before he got killed, Marcus went to Washington and saved the Pacific Northwest from a British Catholic plot to take it away from America. That's a story that I learned that was sort of sanctified by the state of Washington, and that was in the 1960s. And that's my first memory of the story.
This was in textbooks too, right?
It was in textbooks. It had been really the great story of the making of the Pacific Northwest since about the late 1870s when it was made up.
Was it pretty impactful on you when you were younger?
Well, that's the thing about learning things in school when you're a little kid is you're excited by the story, and because your teachers tell you it's true, you believe it. And so I believed it. And it wasn't until, 50 years later that I started to examine the story and understand that what they taught me was ridiculous nonsense, and that they should have known it was ridiculous nonsense because 60 years before I learned it, it had been debunked in a very scholarly way by a professor at Yale and by other scholars.
But the myth continued to be perpetuated.
The myth continued to be perpetuated in the Pacific Northwest because it served several purposes. It made the people who lived in the white people who lived in the Pacific Northwest, it gave them a sort of heroic origin story. And it sort of made them actors, champions, and beneficiaries of the greatness of manifest destiny. So that's one of the reasons the story endured. And it also was a way to avoid really looking at what happened to Native Americans in the Pacific Northwest. Of course, what happened to them is that all their land was taken away in an aggressive and sometimes violent way, with a lot of racist trash-talking about Indians that perpetuated into my childhood. And if you had this story about a heroic missionary who saved the Pacific Northwest from a foreign plot and then died at the hand of Indians, then you didn't have to think so seriously about what happened when white settlers came to the Pacific Northwest and took all the land of the people who lived there. It was a way of looking past the truth and making yourself feel good about yourself while doing so. And I think it's in human nature to find stories that make you and your forebears look good.
So I'd love it if we could talk about the Cayuse people. What part of the Pacific Northwest did they live in, do they live in, and what were their interactions with white people before the Whitmans came along?
The Cayuse were a very interesting tribe, a small one that punched way above their weight in terms of military and societal power. They're a small tribe, never more than maybe 1,000, maybe 1,200 people at their peak. They lived in and around the Columbia Plateau, not far from present-day Walla Walla, on the border between northeast Oregon and southeast Washington State. Their land straddled the Columbia River and the Walla Walla River and the Umatilla River. And the way they made their living was with horses. They were the first tribe in the Columbia Plateau to go south and bring back large numbers of horses, which they became expert riders and breeders of, selling them to their closely affiliated and much larger tribe, the Nez Perce. And then using the horses for trading, for raiding other tribes, for slaving. They went all the way into the Midwest to get buffalo. They went to the coast to trade for stuff that came from on ships that were arriving. And they were also early adopters of other technology. I mean, the horse was a new technology for the tribes in North America, and the Cayuse were early adopters, but they were also early adopters of guns, cooking pots, blankets. And to get to the missionaries, is they were also early adopters of other people's religions, which they saw as a possible adjunct or addition to their power. And which they thought might prepare them for what they knew was going to be an inevitable and overwhelming rush of white settlers into the area. So they invited Marcus and Narcissa Whitman to live on their traditional land, and so that they could learn about their white god in hopes that it might give them an additional piece of weaponry to fight against their fellow tribes and against the coming white people.
So, yeah, speaking of the Whitmans, would you talk a bit about Marcus and Narcissa Whitman, their decision to come west, specifically to the Walla Walla River?
Yes. They came from upstate New York. They came from a part of New York that was known at the time as the Burned Over area, the Burned Over region, Burned Over district. And they came of age in the 1820s, 1830s, when there was this incredible wave of Christian evangelism in the United States. It was called the Second Great Awakening. And it began at the end of the 18th century when, maybe 1 or 2%, 1 or 2 out of every 10 Americans went to church regularly. By the late 1830s, when they came west, about 8 out of 10 Americans went to church regularly. And there was this the great evangelizing spirit in the country, supported by church donations, that sent missionaries around the world and across North America to convert and save what they called the heathen. And Marcus Whitman, who was a medical doctor, and Narcissa Whitman, who was a very pious, church-going young woman, they were sort of swept away on a current of romantic idealism about going and converting the heathen. And in doing so, saving themselves and preserving a place for themselves in heaven. They were very ethnocentric in the sense that they had no interest in the people they were converting other than to make them Christians as they defined Christianity.
What denomination did they belong to?
They were Presbyterian. that was the denomination that dominated their area in upstate New York. But they also worked with Congregationalists, and they went west with the approval and with the financing of a Boston-based missionary organization that basically was the primary sponsor of missionaries around the world. And they worked for and at the pleasure of this missionary organization in Boston.
And on their way west, they traveled with a man named Henry Spaulding, correct?
Right. Spaulding is really the dark hero of the story. He was like Narcissa and Marcus Whitman. He was a person born in the burned over area, a convert to an evangelistic Calvinist version of Christianity. And he was also an ordained minister, which Marcus Whitman wasn't. And the backstory between Spaulding and Narcissa Whitman is that they grew up in the same small town, Plattsburgh, New York, and they went to the same sort of junior college together. Narcissa was from a relatively affluent family. She had nice clothes and a nice home to go home to. Spaulding was the bastard son of a mother who was also born out of wedlock. He had very little money. He had a really, really sketchy education. But he managed, because he was hardworking, he managed to go to this junior college there in the town. And he met Narcissa, who had a beautiful singing voice and by many reports was physically very attractive. And he fell for her and proposed marriage. And she told him no way at all. She rejected him. And then about 5 years later, it turns out that they traveled west together in the same group of wagons all the way to Oregon. Narcissa had by that time married Dr. Whitman, and Spaulding had found himself a wife named Eliza. But Spaulding never forgot and never forgave Narcissa, or for that matter, Dr. Whitman, for his embarrassment and his rejection when he was younger. And so he tormented them during many of the years that they were out in the Pacific Northwest. They arrived in 1836, and the Whitmans were killed in 1847, 11 years later. And during that time, Spaulding was basically a thorn in their side. Narcissa wrote a letter to her father saying, "We never should have come west with this guy because he's caused us nothing but pain and heartache." But after they were killed in the Whitman massacre, which we'll discuss in a minute, Spaulding decided to turn the people that he had tormented into iconic Western heroes. He made up a story, the story that Marcus Whitman saved the Pacific Northwest, and then he sold that story to the entire country by taking it to the U.S. Capitol and getting Congress to reprint it. And once it was reprinted, it became a original source document, and newspapers and magazines and the intelligentsia, the establishment in America, swallowed the story, and it became, for several decades, the official history of how the Pacific Northwest became the part of the United States. And it was all made up by Henry Spaulding, the man who had been rejected by Narcissa.
So when the Whitmans first arrived and built the mission, things went well with the Cayuse, at least for the first year or two.
They did. Christianity had sort of percolated out across the plains and into the Pacific Northwest in several ways. Some Iroquois Indians from New York who had been pushed out of their land, they found their way west. some Catholic traders who worked for the Hudson's Bay Company and other fur trading outfits had passed on bits and pieces of Christianity. And so when the Whitmans arrived and started holding services just outside of Walla Walla at the mission they built there, they were surprised that the Cayuse were interested and seemed to actually have some idea what was going on in a church service. And so they felt that they were making great progress. Neither Narcissa nor Marcus really learned to speak the language that the Cayuse spoke, which was Nez Perce language at that point. But they believed that they were making progress. In fact, they weren't. The Cayuse were hoping that having these representative of a white man's God would give them some supernatural edge. But as the years went by, they saw nothing of real benefit from having these missionaries squat on their land and refuse to pay rent, and also refuse to leave when they were told to go. So the blood between the Cayuse and the missionaries became increasingly bad over the years. And it made much worse by the constant arrival of more white people, which kept making the Cayuse and all the tribes on the Columbia Plateau more nervous. And along with white people came white people's diseases. There had been several waves of catastrophic infections from smallpox, from malaria, and from measles. And in some, they wiped out between 80 and 95% of all the Native Americans living in the Pacific Northwest before and in the very first years of white settlement. So the Cayuse, along with virtually every other Indian tribe, was edgy, angry, suspicious. And that's the kind of relationship that the missionaries had with the Cayuse.
So the Cayuse treated Dr. Whitman as they would a tribal medicine man.
That's right. That's right.
And they watched with concern as Whitman treated both the Cayuse and the whites for the same disease. And the treatments appeared to the Cayuse to be working on the whites, but not so much on the Cayuse.
Right. Particularly with measles. You know, measles is still among the most infectious viruses known to man. But measles was not completely unfamiliar to the biology of white people. They'd lived with it and been around it for, it was a European disease. So when it arrived in the Pacific Northwest, you know, it cut a terrible swath through the population, moving very quickly. White people would get sick and get miserable and usually recover. Indians would get sick and die, overwhelmingly, especially children. And the Cayuse leadership saw this, and they saw that Whitman was treating his patients the same by bleeding them. That was one of his major techniques. And those who were bled, who were white, seemed to recover, and those who were bled, who were Indians, seemed to die. And so they concluded that Whitman was, you know, either a total idiot and incompetent, or was actually trying to kill the Indians. In any case, they had a long tradition that Whitman knew about, that he actually had written about at some length, that said failed medicine men who worked among the Cayuse, they have to be really, really good, or they have to be quick on their feet and get out of town, because otherwise they'll be killed. And that's what happened to him. He was actually warned multiple times by the Cayuse elders and by other knowledgeable white people, including the head of the Hudson's Bay Company for the Pacific Northwest, John McLaughlin, to get out of there, at least for a few years, and let things calm down. But he was a stubborn person who refused to move. By the time Whitman was killed in 1847, he and his wife had basically lost interest in their original missionary goals, which was to bring religion to the Cayuse and, you know, baptize them and convert them. Instead, they were, she had become a teacher of white orphan kids whose parents had died on the Oregon Trail or once they arrived in Oregon. And he had become sort of a real estate developer, trying to get land from the federal government and welcoming these increasing numbers of missionaries, of settlers who arrived every year. So they started coming at like 200 a year, and then 400 a year, then 600 a year, and then 2,000 a year, as Indians just freaked out that they were becoming a minority in their own land.
We'll be back in a moment. And we have returned. A lot of the tension between the Whitmans and the Cayuse had to do with personal space. Members of the Cayuse, you write, as part of their culture, didn't believe so much in personal space, and especially in this case, as they believed that the land that the Whitmans were on was theirs. So members of the tribe would walk into the Whitman house, help themselves to food, and Narcissa complained about this. She complained that they smelled, etc. And this increased her indifference towards the Cayuse as a whole. I mean, she tried not to interact with them at all.
I think that was part of it. You know, she grew up in a pretty comfortable, highly social, rather privileged background in New York. Her father was a judge, a landowner, and a business person. Her mother was a very active and highly respected organizer in the Presbyterian Church. So Narcissa was happiest when she could go into a church on Sunday, sing with her beautiful, pure soprano voice, maybe organize some sort of church meeting, and then go home to a nice supper. If you come to the Pacific Northwest and live on Cayuse land that they have given you, it would behoove someone to sort of change their expectations about what life would be like. But she really didn't. She didn't learn the language. She didn't understand what the Cayuse thought or how they thought or what their religious values and beliefs were other than Christianity. The ethnocentrism was almost complete, where she just basically summed up the their entirety as with one word: they were heathens. And also, when she arrived in the Pacific Northwest in 1836, she was nearing 30, and she was pregnant for the first time in her life. And she gave birth to a healthy, by all accounts, vivacious young daughter who was a joy of their lives and really gave Narcissa a reason to live. And the birth, it was actually celebrated by the Cayuse because it was the first white child born to settlers in that part of the country. And so the daughter, Clarissa, was a uniting element and a reason for joy, but she drowned in the river one Sunday afternoon when Marcus and Narcissa were busy reading. And after that, Narcissa, understandably, was incredibly depressed, and she sort of withdrew from her missionary goals and became a rather depressed, isolated person who should have left, who should have gone back to upstate New York and started over, but she didn't leave.
There is some suggestion, you write, that to prevent the Cayuse from foraging through their vegetable gardens, and again, helping themselves to their food, either the Whitmans or someone on the property put poison on the food. I think it might have been a melon patch specifically, and it was meant to be a deterrent, right?
There were some rumors that had happened. The evidence of that is pretty sketchy. But in any case, the Cayuse believed it. They believed that Marcus Whitman was poisoning them, and it was part of a plot to take their land. And they blamed Narcissa as well. And they also blamed Henry Spaulding as being a co-conspirator in this effort to poison the Indians and take their land. And My personal belief is that I don't think that the Whitmans or Spalding, they weren't murderers. I mean, they weren't killing Indians on purpose. It was their ethnocentrism, their cultural blinders that were the killing ingredient for them. I don't think that they intentionally tried to poison the Indians. The evidence of that is not strong. But in any case, the Indians did believe it, and it was well known among tribe members that there was something like that going on.
And to add fuel to the fire, an emigrant from Maine named Joe Lewis arrived to the mission, and he began spreading rumors, stirring the pot.
Joe Lewis was the primary fomenter of trouble. But as I said, you know, everything was already ready to go up in flames because there was so much anger. And in the weeks and days before the massacre occurred in late November of 1847, about half of the Cayuse tribe died from measles, and even a higher percentage of children. And so the Cayuse men, they were just crazy with fear, looking for a scapegoat. And in walked Joe Lewis, this guy who was of mixed Indian and white blood, who'd come from Maine and who had learned lots of stories about white perfidy across the United States. And he arrived, and he sort of helped put a match to this very, very volatile, flammable situation.
So you write in your book that on November 29th, a cold and foggy Monday, several Cayuse men called on Whitman after lunchtime. They asked for medicine. Can you walk us through what happened next?
What happened was that Whitman invited a couple of those people into his kitchen to discuss the situation with measles. And while they were having this conversation, the reports were that one of the braves, one of the fighters, a prominent guy named Tomahawk, he walked around behind Whitman and buried a tomahawk in his skull. Whitman fell to the ground. Then he was shot in the neck. And then later he was dragged outside and tomahawked some more and basically chopped up. Narcissa, at the same time, was in the house in another room, and she was shot, tricked to come outside saying all was clear. And once she got outside, she was also shot, tomahawked, and chopped to pieces as well. 11 other white people, all of them men, were killed. They killed no woman except for Narcissa, and it was very clear that they wanted to kill Narcissa. And all of this happened on that one day. And then everybody else in the mission, and there were about 40 people, many young students who were sort of orphan students of Narcissa at the mission, and then other people who'd arrived on the Oregon Trail, they were taken hostage. And then began a hostage negotiation that took several weeks.
So one of those hostages was Henry Spalding's daughter, Eliza. How did word get to Spalding about what had happened, and how did he react?
The Spalding story in the days after the massacre, I think, is the most interesting and dramatic and deeply human part of the book. So, as you said, Spalding's daughter, who was, I think, about 12, Eliza, was there. And she was studying with the help of Narcissa, learning, you know, to read and stuff like that. And 2 days after the massacre, and the news of the massacre had not yet spread, Spalding was in the area, and he wanted to ride over to the mission and see how his daughter was doing, if she had gotten measles, because he knew it was in the area, if she had survived. He just wanted to see his daughter. So on the, just outside of the mission, he ran into a Catholic priest, Father Brulé, and Brulé had just been at the mission where he'd seen all the bodies that had been created by this mass killing 2 days earlier. Brulé had helped bury those bodies. He'd tried to calm down the Indians, and he had left, in fact, to try to find Spalding to warn him that the Indians wanted to kill him too. He was the very much at the top of their hit list for perfidious missionaries that needed to be killed. So Brulé reached out and actually held Spalding's hand and told him what had happened to the Whitmans and told him that his daughter was safe. She was a hostage, but she was safe. And he told Spalding to turn around on his horse and ride like hell out of there because the Indians were going to kill him. And Spalding did as he was advised by this priest, rode east to his mission, which was a couple days' ride to the east, a place called Lapway, which is now in Idaho, and he got away. But what's really interesting about that encounter with the Roman Catholic priest is that Spalding hated Roman Catholics. He had been educated in New York and in and around Cleveland, Ohio, in a tradition of real, real hatred of Roman Catholics. Roman Catholics during those years were coming into the country in extraordinary numbers, and there was a real fear by Protestants that these papists, these people who reported to a commander in Rome, were going to ruin America. And Spalding was a champion of that belief. And yet, because he had run into Brulé, he was not dead. He owed his life to the compassion and bravery of this Catholic priest. And this was something that really drove Spalding crazy the rest of his life. And the way he dealt with it, which is basically the second half of the book, the way Spalding dealt with owing his life to a representative of a church that he hated was to lie about it. He very quickly, within 6 months, was saying that Brulé had been a organizer of the killing at the Whitman mission, and that there was blood on his hands, literally, blood on his hands while he was baptizing the Indians who had just killed the Whitmans. There was blood everywhere, and it was all because the Catholics and the British were so sneaky. This was the story that he made up over the course of the next 20 years and sold to the U.S. Congress and to the New York Times and the Ladies' Home Journal and virtually every history book written in the United States about the Pacific Northwest between 1880 and 1905.
And as part of that interaction with the Catholic priest, you write that a Cayuse warrior named Edward, who was the son of Chief Tilokite, I hope I'm pronouncing that right. Tilokite had been involved in the murders. This warrior named Edward had been dispatched to kill Spalding. And the priest had defused the situation at least long enough for Spalding to make his escape.
Right. Yeah. Brulé was a very interesting figure. He was born and educated in Eastern Canada in and around, I think it was Toronto, maybe Montreal. But he had grown up in sort of the Jesuit tradition of, you know, learning to speak Greek and Latin and understand he was a broadly educated, sophisticated guy with a good mind and a real ability to adapt to his circumstances. And so after he'd stumbled upon this killing at the mission and he was allowed to bury the bodies, he heard that Spalding would be next. And when he left the mission to try to find Spalding, the Cayuse sent along Tilokite's son to keep an eye on him, and if he happened to see Spalding, to kill him. Spalding persuaded Edward to give Spalding a break and think about it. Maybe he shouldn't kill him right away or something like that. And Edward said, well, I got to go talk to my chiefs about this. And so he rode back a couple miles for a discussion. And it was in that window while he was checking out what he should do that Brule told Spalding to beat it. And Spalding managed to ride away before a hunting party came after him. Spalding was a poor horse rider. A couple days before this had happened, he had fallen off his horse and sort of screwed up his knee. So he wasn't a particularly speedy missionary as he fled east, but he was a knowledgeable guy who'd made the journey between Walla Walla and Idaho hundreds of times in the previous years. So he really knew how to find his way, and he was quite lucky to get there. Even though he lost his horse and he ended up walking a lot of the way without any boots, but he did manage to make it back to the Nez Perce country, where he was relatively safe.
So it fell partly to the Hudson's Bay Company, the British fur traders who had been in that area for a long time, to try and negotiate an end to all of this, right?
Right. The killing of the missionaries and 11 other white people quickly became infamous as the Whitman Massacre. Nothing quite so horrible for white people had occurred in the Pacific Northwest in the known history of the region. There were lots of white settlers by then, several thousand, living in the Willamette Valley over in western Oregon on the western side of the Cascades. It took a while before news of the massacre reached those white people, but as soon as they heard, they wanted to organize a party to go and kill Indians in large numbers. The Hudson's Bay Company, which was a chartered British company which had been there in the region trading for furs, and working with all the tribes rather successfully and profitably, when it learned that the Whitmans had been killed along with these other people, it knew that this was going to be a disaster that potentially could wreck their business and quickly turn this part of the country into a territory of the United States. When the murder occurred, the British and the United States had a treaty of sort of shared ownership of the Northwest. The rules were rather vague, but they both lived there in relative harmony. But the British Hudson's Bay Company, they could see it immediately as a disaster in the making. And so what the management of the Hudson's Bay Company did is they seized control. They sent out a party of armed men led by a trader who was extremely experienced in dealing with the tribes. And he went to the Cayuse and to the Nez Perce and said, well, I want you to surrender the hostages immediately, and we'll give you some guns and some blankets and some food as a trade. But unless you make this trade and you do it right away, white people are going to come from the Willamette Valley, and they'll probably also come at some point from Washington, D.C., by the President of the United States, and they're going to kill you all. So please make a deal. And they did. The Cayuse and the Nez Perce and the other tribes agreed to give the hostages up, and by that time they included Henry Spalding and his family and some other white people who lived among the Nez Perce, and they all got on a Hudson's Bay Company boats, went downstream on the Columbia, and survived. And the Hudson's Bay Company did manage, by really excellent management, to save their business operation in the Northwest for another 10, 15 years.
So even though the hostages were released, that didn't appease settlers entirely. They were still enraged. And there were now stories coming from the hostages that they had been mistreated, including one from a young woman named Lorinda Bewley. I think I'm pronouncing that correctly, right?
Yeah.
Who shared stories of her captivity.
Right. So there was always in the American experience among Native Americans this incredible anger and desire for vengeance when the Indians, who couldn't take being pushed around anymore, started fighting back. And that's what happened with the Cayuse. They killed these whites, and then the surviving whites, who by that time outnumbered and outgunned the Indians, they responded disproportionately and with great prejudice, or they tried to. And that's the story of the entire American West. And it was always made worse when there was a white woman killed, as Narcissa was, or when there was a young white woman sexually molested, as Lorinda Bewley was, or said she was. So the story of her being taken by a Cayuse chief and being unutterably and unspeakably abused, as it was described in the newspapers at the time, it really made the blood boil among whites and fomented a desire for vengeance. And what happened is, at the same time as the whites in the Willamette Valley were sort of eager for a war against the Indians, they weren't well prepared for it. They didn't have much money. They didn't have any military leadership, not many arms. And so what they wanted to do was to use the provocation of this massacre as a news event that would get the U.S. government in Washington to finally make the Pacific Northwest an official territory of the United States, which is something that President Polk at the time said he wanted to do. The whites in the Willamette Valley shrewdly saw this as a trigger, a pivotal, sort of a turning point, tipping point, that would finally force the President of the United States and the U.S. Congress to stop dilly-dallying and do so and make this decision to turn the Oregon country into a territory. So they sent back a guy named Joe Meek, who was a trapper who'd known the Whitmans. He went back to Washington, talked to President Polk, whose wife actually was his second cousin, and persuaded Polk and the U.S. Congress to do exactly what the people in the Willamette Valley wanted, which was to make the Pacific Northwest into a territory. And within a couple decades, then it became the states of Oregon, Washington, and later Idaho. So what Whitman and his wife did, I mean, their big achievement was to get killed and create this tipping point that turned the Pacific Northwest into a part of the continental United States and completed the formation of a continental country. That's what the Whitmans actually did by dying. And then, as I said, Spaulding, because he was an angry, Catholic-hating, resentful person who had been dumped by Narcissa, in his fevered imagination, he came up with the story that Whitman had saved the Pacific Northwest before he died, and then was actually killed for having done so. And that's the story that I ended up learning when I was a kid.
We will return momentarily. And we're back again. So how was Whitman the savior of the Pacific Northwest? What was he supposed to have done that was so heroic?
So the story sort of, the story that Spaulding fabricated evolved over time. But sort of the final version of the story is that Whitman was in 1841, doing his doctoring work, doing his missionary work, and that he was invited to dinner at a Hudson's Bay Company sort of party at Fort Walla Walla, not far from his mission. And while he was sitting at the table, he in Spalding's fictitious version of history, he heard the Hudson's Bay Company people talk about how a large number of Roman Catholic Canadians had just arrived in the Pacific Northwest, and this would be the arrival that would change the complexion of the region, turning it into a part of Britain, and that the British basically had won the country. That's what the discussion was at dinner, according to the story that Spalding made up. And then, according to the story that Spalding made up, Whitman jumped up from the table, went to his horse, got on the horse, and then rode to his wife, who was a few miles away, and said, "I must go to Washington. I must save the country. Don't worry about me. I'll be back, I hope." And he rode across the country with his horse through terrible winter snows and burst into the White House. And the president at the time, John Tyler, was there, along with the Secretary of State, Webster. And Whitman, according to the story that Spalding made up, told these important people that the British were coming. America had no time to lose, and we need reinforcements. So Tyler gave him the reinforcements, and then Whitman supposedly led a wagon train that came back to save the Pacific Northwest. And the United States then never allowed Britain to take the Pacific Northwest. So that's the fake story, and that's the one that everyone ended up believing until it was debunked.
So in the aftermath of these murders, the Cayuse were feeling tremendous pressure, and they decided that the best course of action was basically to find five of their own, hand them over, and they hoped that doing this would put an end to the drama, right?
Right. When Joe Meek, the emissary from the Willamette Valley, got to Washington, and Congress decided to make the Pacific Northwest a territory, three things happened. Is the Polk dispatched a couple thousand men on horseback, the cavalry, to go to Oregon to sort things out. And then he also sent a judge, a prosecutor, and a governor out to the territory. And the goal of these high personages and these well-armed people was to bring the Cayuses to justice and to make sure that nothing as terrible as the Whitman Massacre ever happened again. This cavalry unit actually rode across Cayuse country, and the tribal leaders saw, this big army, well-armed with all these horses, and they knew that they could not deal with them. And so they decided to sort of round up the usual suspects, so to speak. They found five people that they said were involved in the massacre, and they gave them to the Americans. And the Americans then took them on a boat down to Oregon City, which was the largest city in the Pacific Northwest at the time. It's now a suburb of Portland, where they were tried. And on the way down, in one of the, it's a quote that may be apocryphal, but it's attributed fairly well to the memory of one of the people involved in the trial, is that Tilakite, who was the most senior of the elders who were arrested for their participation in the massacre, he said that they were sacrificial lambs, and he and Tilakite had also been a translator for many of the sermons that Marcus Whitman had delivered at his mission before he was killed. And Tilakite had clearly been paying attention to the Christian message. And Tilakite said that just as your Christ had died to save your people from the devil, so we will go and die to save our people. And they did. They went down to Oregon City, or they went west to Oregon City, and there they were tried, convicted, and hanged in the first really formal murder trial in the history of the Pacific Northwest. And a mass gallows was built, and they were hanged simultaneously one afternoon with a huge crowd, maybe 15% to 30% of all the people in the Pacific Northwest came to the hanging. And then they were buried on the edge of town.
they were represented by a man named Captain Thomas Claiborne, who was not a friend of Henry Spaulding by any means. But part of the defense's strategy was to argue that the murders happened on Cayuse land, not American land, which meant that Cayuse law applied in this case.
Right. This was a trial that had all the rules and formalities, procedures of a federal trial that you might even see today. Evidence, a grand jury indictment, you know, the finding of a jury, prosecutor, all of that. And so the defense strategy in the trial was to say that the murder occurred outside of the formal jurisdiction of the United States. It occurred before the region had become a territory, and it was in it was outside of the officially designated Indian country, which was to the south around Oklahoma. It was basically, it happened on the sovereign land of the Cayuse tribe. And as such, the laws that should apply there are not U.S. laws, but Cayuse traditional law, which for centuries had sanctioned and practiced the execution of failed medicine men. This argument was made. It made a certain jurisdictional sense. But the judge in the case, who'd been appointed by President Polk, he said no. He realized that the trial was an exercise in vengeance, and that if he were to let these Indians live on the basis of a legal technicality, that his career as a politician, as a judge, as a man who would later become very, very rich in the American West, would probably end. So he threw out all their objections and quickly moved towards a conviction.
You write that the jury didn't deliberate long, just over an hour before coming back with a guilty verdict. And of the five convicted men, three of them were terrified, not of being executed, which they expected, but of being hanged. And hanging was a really foreign idea for them.
Right. The Cayuse were a warlike people. They raided, they slaved, they murdered, they stabbed, they shot. And in return, when they lost, they were stabbed and shot as well. But in their cosmology of war, nobody was ever hanged. They never hanged anybody. And they thought that it was completely foreign to all of their values to be hanged like a dog, they described it. They much wanted to be shot or to be knifed. And they complained about the hanging bitterly until they were hanged.
Joe Meek, who was responsible for administering the hangings. By the way, his daughter had died, right? So this was a little personal for
him. His daughter was there at the mission when the massacre occurred. She was not killed, but she did have measles, and she later died. And her body was found at the mission, and actually Joe Meek saw her body when he was heading east to report to Washington, D.C. what had happened. He went through the mission and saw several bodies, including, he said, the body of his daughter. And so when the Cayuse five were hanged, not all of them died the moment that they fell from the gallows when the trapdoor opened. Many of them sort of struggled at the end of their rope. And Tomahawk among them, the one who allegedly struck the first blow. And Meek reports in a biography written about him that he put his foot on that noose and tightened it up till Tomahawk went quiet.
So after the hangings, basically the floodgates opened, right, for settlers?
Right. The hangings were the pivot point that made Oregon a territory. Once it became a territory, there were laws passed for land, for showing up, you got land. And then people began to show up in the tens and then the hundreds of thousands. And the Native Americans, as elsewhere in the West, quickly became a small minority in their homeland.
So Whitman College is really well known in the Pacific Northwest. How did it get its name? How is it connected to all of this? And how has it fared amidst these changing views regarding the Whitman name?
The Whitman story is very interesting. It was founded by one of the other missionaries who came out with Whitman in the 1830s. And it founded about 15 years or so after the Whitman killing as a sort of memorial to Whitman and as a way to have a religious college in eastern Oregon and Washington. It was just above the border of Oregon in southeast Oregon, near Walla Walla. So the college was founded. It struggled mightily to find students and also to pay its bills. In the mid-1890s, this was after Spalding had made up the lie about Whitman saving the Pacific Northwest, the school was on the brink of bankruptcy. Its president had recently been fired and left town, and they had a new young president named Stephen Penrose, who had arrived from Philadelphia, had gone to Williams, was an upper-class Easterner who didn't really know much about the history, particularly about the Native Americans of the Pacific Northwest. But he was a very smart, ambitious guy who wanted to save the college. He walked into the Whitman's scruffy little library and found a book that rehashed the lie about Whitman saving the Northwest. And Penrose read that story, and he had this aha moment. He said, "This is a story that will save the college. This is a story that will make everybody excited when they hear about it in pews across the East Coast." So he boiled that story down to its essence, that Whitman had been sort of the Christ of missionaries who had given his very blood so that the Pacific Northwest could live. And it was the least that a good Protestant living in Boston or New York or Philadelphia or Chicago, the least they could do was to give Whitman College some money so that Whitman would not have died in vain. Penrose, with that simple, dramatic, heroic message of manifest destiny and Christian goodness, took that to Chicago. And then he took it around the country, and he raised the equivalence of tens of millions of dollars on the back of the lie, saved the college, and turned it into what it now is, which is probably the best private college in the Pacific Northwest and one of the top 40 in the United States. It really is a terrific small private college, and I spent a lot of time there in its library. But he ran with the lie, and even after it was debunked in 1900, he continued to run with it until he died about 35 years later.
So one final question. Is this Whitman story now generally accepted as being debunked, or do some still teach it?
I'm happy to report that the publication of my book last year coincided with a sea change in public understanding of this issue and in the way Whitman is recognized officially by the state of Washington. The state of Washington, in its wisdom, had chosen Whitman in the 1950s to be a representative of the finest in achievement by a settler in the state and sent a statue of him back to Washington, D.C. to be honored in the Hall of Statuary at the U.S. Capitol. This occurred 50 years after the Whitman story was debunked as a ridiculous lie. But as I said at the beginning of our conversation, Whitman represented an ideal of American settler ingenuity and courage, and that ideal overcame any truthiness about what he actually did or didn't do. But last year, when my book came out, the state legislature decided to remove Whitman from the Hall of Statuary in Washington and replace him with the a statue of Billy Frank Jr., who was a Native American activist who demanded the fishing rights that were embodied in the various treaties that Indians had signed with whites in the 1900s, in the 1800s. And so Whitman's statue is being removed from Washington, D.C. It's also going to be removed from the state capitol in Olympia. And at Whitman College, there's a statue of Whitman that is also going to be removed at some point. At the same time, Whitman College has tried to make amends for running with the lie about Whitman by offering full scholarships to five tribal students from the Umatilla Reservation, where the Cayuse have been consigned for the past 100 and some years. So a great deal has changed in just the past year.
Well, thanks so much for coming on and talking about this with us. So where can we direct listeners who want to learn more about you and your book?
I have a website, blainharden.com. And, you know, the book, it just came out in paperback with a new epilogue that explains a lot of the things that I just mentioned, that the story of Whitman has finally been digested and the truth is being absorbed by the higher-ups who run everything in the Pacific Northwest.
Well, thank you again for your time.
Thank you. It was a great interview.
Again, I have been speaking to Blaine Harden. He is the author of Murder at the Mission, A Frontier Killing, Its Legacy of Lies, and The Taking of the American West. This has been another episode of the Most Notorious podcast, broadcasting to every dark and cobwebbed corner of the world. I'm Eric Rivenis, and have a safe tomorrow.